to Where Brains Meet Beauty, hosted by Jodi Katz, founder and creative director of Base Beauty Creative Agency.
We had our team at many different events this summer. So a couple of them were vacay events for Kaoli, our fragrance client. This was a two-part immersive activation they did all in 1 week. The first piece was in LA and the second piece was in Houston.
I love that we had a party on the road, right? So this was designed to celebrate a destination-inspired vacay collection. So it's four different fragrances, each one themed to a different exotic location. And we were able to transport guests into these sensory escapes, and everything was so tailored to the vibe of the fragrance, the mood, the notes, and people don't want to leave the parties. They love them so much.
That is exactly right. People were there like till sundown. And as we were planning, we were like, you know, it's the summer. It's so challenging to get people there. So our team was incredibly thoughtful about what are those moments that are going to make this feel like a brand explosion. Like, you are going to know Kaoli as soon as you walk in the door. And the attendance rate for both of these markets was incredible. People wanted to be there. They wanted to meet the Kaoli team and experience the fragrances. It was really a great week of events.
Well, you know, when I'm talking with brand CEOs and like heads of marketing, they always want to know, like, is it worth it? Like, is putting the resources and the time into these programs worth it? Mm-hmm. And we can say yes, like 1,000 times yes, right? Like, these types of events generate major EMV, earn media value, and they get the message out, right? It's also about goodwill, like strengthening relationships with creators, increasing brand awareness. And we're able to do that in beauty and in other lifestyle categories because of these types of events.
Yeah, absolutely. Kaoli is such a great brand to activate with because they have been for years the leader in putting these community moments on. They have always had such an innovative process for this. So it's been amazing to be part of this. And we have lots more coming up with them this year that we'll be excited to share about.
Well, there will be a vacay case study that we'll share on LinkedIn so people can see the amazing work.
And absolutely.
Client, and we love collaborating with them.
Yes, absolutely. Tell us more about who we have on the show today, Jodi.
This is so fun. So on our show today, we have Rich Gersten. He's from True Beauty Ventures. He's a private equity veteran with over 30 years of experience. And sitting with him was Kara LaForgia of High Ventures. She's a attorney turned venture capitalist. So what's cool about this is I've known Rich for a really, really long time. I mean, maybe I met him like 10 years ago before I had any game or clue as to what his business is and what's happening here. And Kara is a newer friend, so it was great to sit with both of them.
Yeah, it was an amazing conversation to listen in on. Two investors with very unique, different, but equally compelling paths into beauty investing.
On this episode, you'll hear what it really takes to succeed in beauty investing, from building strong networks and leveraging mentorship to navigating the emotionally taxing world of fundraising. This was an amazing conversation. I never even really thought about what it's like for someone in PE to raise the money, but this is a deep, deep look into it. I hope people really listen in.
Yes, absolutely. Rich shares stories of persistence and raising capital and the importance of trusting your gut. And Kara opens up about her journey from financial insecurity to financial freedom and the mindset that it takes to get there. So together on this episode, both of them are examining really amazing themes, how their upbringing shaped their work, and their evolving definitions of success, both personally and professionally.
So if you're a founder, investor, or CEO, or just curious about the world of early stage beauty and wellness, this conversation offers very rare, honest insights from two people who've seen the industry from the inside out.
Let's get to it. Here is more from our friends Rich Gersten and Kara LaForgia in episode 291.
Hey, beauty founders, brand builders, and industry insiders, are you ready to level up?
Our friends at Kosako are back for the 9th annual edition of Beauty Connect. It is happening November 3rd through the 5th at the gorgeous Fairmont Century Plaza in Los Angeles.
Beauty Connect is the industry's go-to problem-solving platform. Our COO, Sarah Lavallee, will be joining this year for Base Beauty.
You'll also be surrounded by some of your favorite brands, Supergoop, House Labs, L'Occitane, Nordstrom, Bloomingdale's, and Beekman 1802.
We're talking curated one-on-one meetings, a luxe gift bag, intimate closed-door dinners with retailers, investors, and your sharpest peers.
Head to beautyconnectla.com and use our code WBMB for 10% off your ticket.
Let us know if you'll be attending. Your next big break could be in that room. welcome everybody to Where Brains Meet Beauty. We're on the front lines of raising capital, making deals, making magic happen with Rich Gersten. He's a co-founder and general partner of True Beauty Ventures, and Cara LaForgia, founder and managing partner at Hive Ventures. Thank you both for being here today. This is going to be really fun. We're a career journey show, so we'll get into nuts and bolts about the job in a little while, but we want to go back in time. When you're little kids, we start to dream about what our future career is going to be. So we'll start with you, Cara. When you're 11 years old, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I wanted to be a doctor.
What kind of doctor?
Any doctor. Anything that can make me the most amount of money.
Okay. You're driven by financial incentives.
I am, not helping people. Both.
And Rich?
When I was that old, I probably wanted to be a professional athlete, but I soon realized that that likely was not going to happen. As I started to mature in years, I think I first thought I'd be an architect, then an accountant because I liked numbers, and by the time I got to college, it was finance and investing. So I morphed, but I quickly gave up on the dream of professional basketball. It wasn't going to happen.
Okay, I hear that, but I think you're an architect now, an architect of other things, right?
Perhaps, but I like the floor plans and mechanical drafting I did.
So I just want to acknowledge that I met you many, many years ago, like the infancy of me running Base Beauty, and I was introduced to you by Alana Zeifer, who was here a few minutes ago, and she's the person, I told this in the first session, she literally sat me down one day and she explained, this is what PE is, this is what investment bankers are, like I had no idea, it was such a mystery to me, I'm so glad she did this. And gosh, I've watched your business change so much through the years because you're now your own business, but you're part of another firm at the time. I mean, Cara, I got to meet you at Beauty Connect, which is our partner for this series today. So it's really cool to bring you both together. We're going to have a really wide-ranging conversation. This is the first time we've had this theme on our show, and we're almost 300 episodes. So we really have denied our fans a chance to learn more about your type of career. So I want to dig deep with you. So we'll start with you, Cara. How do you find your way to, hey, I'm going to start a fund and invest in brand? I mean, this is like a really long road, I would imagine. Where do you start in your career?
Yeah, so I'm a lawyer by trade. It was definitely an extremely unconventional path. I started my career as an NFL sports agent when I was in law school. I also worked for Birdman and Lidoane at Cash Money Records, and then that progressed into eventually being first employee at an apparel company, and then a first employee at another company, starting a consulting business, investing off my balance sheet from that consulting business, and then investing on behalf of other individuals and family offices, which then grew into institutionalizing what I was doing.
I don't know you very well. We haven't like spent time outside of this industry together, but I can totally imagine you being a sports agent. So what did it take?
I could have been a client if it only come through.
So like you have so much grit, I just sense this, right? And ambition. Why not stick in that industry? Why not stay there?
On the record or off the record?
Well, we're recording.
You know, opportunities, like I kind of just like flew with it, and opportunities, I'm a go-getter, I'm a hustler. So as things evolved in my career and I saw an opportunity, I would seize that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that was just a natural progression.
Okay. I want to come back to that. So tell us about how you started out in your career, how you ended up in this world.
Yeah. My first job out of business school was in private equity. So I've been in the industry in some form or fashion for over 30 years.
Okay. So our previous guest was in learning about mortgage banks. What was your first PE world?
I was a generalist, but I did a lot of consumer because consumer is such a big part of, obviously, our total economy. In the late 90s, I joined a new firm that was being raised called Northcastle Partners, which was a consumer sector focused fund focused on kind of health and wellness trends, a little bit ahead of its time, but like very early in the whole notion of consumer sector focused investing. And I stumbled, honestly, into beauty investing over 20 years ago. I just made an investment in a company called Avalon Natural Products. And 2 years later, I made an investment in a skincare brand called DDF. And then the founder of Northcastle said, Rich, you should spend 50% of your time just focused on the beauty space. And I think my answer to him was something along the lines of go F yourself.
Not embrace it?
Not initially. I mean, it was just another industry, but I had done food and beverage, I had done supplements, I had done other things. But he was the founder, and I listened to him. And I remember attending my first Women's Wear Daily Beauty CEO Summit literally almost 20 years ago, and I was the only private equity investor at that event. There was, I think, two or three investment bankers there. And if you fast forward to today, there's as many bankers and investors as there are beauty executives at those events now. So it was very, very different. But somewhere along the way, I just self-mandated that I was only going to do beauty investing. It was about 10 years ago. I didn't think it was enough to keep me busy originally. It was. I was good at it. I loved it. And then I started True Beauty Ventures with a former colleague about 5 years ago, and I wish I had done it sooner. Mm-hmm. So it's actually been an incredible experience.
So to clarify for both of you, when you say beauty, does that mean beauty, wellness, personal care, or does it just mean like pure traditional beauty?
All of it.
For me, it's all of it, include, and then also to add longevity and women's right. health and wellness.
Right. We would include that too.
Okay. So, yes, we have a nomenclature situation in our industry that makes it hard for us to all speak the same language.
Which wasn't the case 5 years ago, though.
Right, right.
I would also throw in pet and travel in my bucket.
Yeah.
That ties into wellness as far as I go by the definition.
So at Base Beauty, we're beauty, wellness, personal care. That's all we work on. And we have a new client that's a very famous cinnamon bun company, which we folded into the wellness category because that's mental health. Like, it makes people happy, and we really wanted to work on this business.
That's so fun.
So we decided that's going to be our wellness play right now.
That's why you have creative in your name.
Yeah, we're very creative. Okay, so let's go back to something you said. Like, you saw opportunities, you seized them. I've always been that way. I'm like, oh, is there like a little door open and no one's here to do this? I'm going to take it. And I worked at L'Occitane Provence a million years ago, and it was very entrepreneurial back then, almost run like a mom and pop company. And I would be like, oh, there's nobody being an art director. I'll be the art director. There's nobody being a creative director. I'll be the creative director. So that's just in me. So I'm hearing it's in you. I get really frustrated when I see people miss opportunities. Like, tell me what it feels like when you're watching opportunities happen and people don't snag them.
I'm too busy that I don't look at anybody else or whatever they're doing, honestly. Like, I'm so laser focused on what I need to achieve and my own ambitions. So unless I guess it's somebody directly related to me, but it's honestly not anything that has crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll notice it now that
maybe.
I mentioned it. You'll
maybe.
Be like, oh my God, you just missed the opportunity of your career. So let's talk about, you know, the businesses that you have. So you're both investing, right? You're early stage. You're, what do you call the stage that you invest?
We're fairly stage agnostic, to be honest.
Okay.
So we're sector specialists, somewhat stage agnostic.
Okay. You work by yourself at this point?
Yes.
And you have a larger team?
We have a team of 5 plus a bunch of advisors.
Mm-hmm. So it's still like a small group. Right. Okay.
We project much bigger.
You do. You really do. Is that part of the magic?
It's just a very hardworking team that's mm-hmm. very dedicated.
Mm-hmm. So these are now very small teams, right, that we're talking about. So the magic is in your minds, right, in your fingertips, right? This isn't about anything but like your institutional knowledge and your industry knowledge. You're looking for opportunities that are going to, you know, turn into bigger opportunities. What are you looking for? And we'll start with you, Rich.
Yeah, when you've been doing it as long as I have, sometimes it's you just see it. You mm-hmm. just know it when you see it. And the earlier you invest, there's less to actually diligence or study.
But so you mean like gut check?
The hardest part of transitioning from later stage investing to earlier stage investing is relying more on your gut
mm-hmm.
and less on the data mm-hmm. than you did in your past. And we constantly pressure test ourselves. And you have to go with your gut. Gut at early stage investing tends to be very founder-centric mm-hmm. gut. Like, mm-hmm. is there something about this founder that you believe can execute and take this to where you think it can go?
Mm-hmm.
But clearly there are things we look for around revenue momentum,
right.
distribution, typically in a major anchor retail partner, very unique to beauty, strong gross margin profile, momentum in earned media value, repeat rates, the typical metrics, if they're around,
mm-hmm.
that any investor would look at. But ultimately, the decision comes down to your gut.
Right. And what are you looking for, Kara?
A founder. So to echo on what Rich has mm-hmm. said, if a founder that, you know, eats, breathes, sleeps what they're building, is really genuinely solving a problem. Usually I'm investing in experienced operators mm-hmm. that have been, you know, former founders and or first employee, upwards to first 15 employee at a very early stage company. Somebody that is just like blow your socks off, so impressive that I go to bed thinking about them and I wake up thinking mm-hmm. about them.
So are you competitors?
Frenemies? No, we're friendly.
Okay, so
we do the same thing. We've never found ourselves competing against each other.
Right, because there's just so many players, and maybe what your checklist of gut check might be different than your gut checklist.
100%.
Is that possible, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about investing in founders. It's kind of like dating, right? And then you're going to get to a marriage. Like, do you find yourself sometimes married to someone who's like a little bit crazy? Rich, we'll start with you.
I would say what we have tried to do universally when we invest is spend time with a founder 6 to 12 months prior to investing. A lot of funds don't have that luxury. They're presented with an opportunity. They have to decide if they want in or out, because we're looking for certain things. We can often pass and then wait. That wait may often be the launch of a retail partner, which then requires more capital, but we might meet them earlier and we take that time to get to know them. We also have a mentorship program where we spend a lot of time with different founders, getting to know them well, and we can assess them for potential investments as well. I'm not ignoring your question other than to say you do date a lot, and sometimes you marry the wrong person.
So this 6 to 12 months, this is a chance to like see them out in the world. Like, do you visit them at their office and watch them?
What we try to do is see if how willing they are to interact and communicate with us, and their willingness to listen and take advice. Because for us as minority investors, the only way we can influence outcomes is by being able to influence the founder in the way he or she thinks. And so if they're receptive to listening, open to listening, ask a lot of questions, put into practice some of the things that you've said, that's a good sign that they'll be a good partner going forward. But if they only call you when they need money, probably a bad sign.
Right. And Kara, what is your process of finding the right partners?
Completely network-based. I spent my entire career building early-stage beauty brands across skincare, haircare, color cosmetics, nails, ingestibles, fragrance, all the things. So I know thousands of operators, former founders, etc. So I source all of my deals exclusively pretty much through that network. And that's, you know, trust with people I've had many years, people that I've worked with that I end up backing in times. To answer your crazy question, I think anyone to start a business from scratch in general, everyone has a little bit of crazy in them.
So that includes you now.
For sure. For sure. To start a venture capital firm, you're...
Yeah, I didn't think I had that gene, but I did.
Yeah, it's intense.
But it's like fun crazy.
It can be.
Of course.
It can be.
Okay, we're talking about right now the where you put your money, but part of your job, which I don't have real visibility into, I watch the, you know, the light deal making happen in front of me, but is the raising capital, right? That's another part of your job. You need people to give you money to make these investments. So talk to me like I'm a kindergartner, Rich. Like, what is that process? And is that something you lead, or is that handed off to someone else on the team? How does that work?
I can honestly say it is the least favorite part of my job. And it also, I think, gives us a unique empathy gene with beauty founders who are raising money. And we always try to share that pain with them because we have to go through it as well. There's nothing worse than asking people you barely know to give you a lot of money. And you should expect to get rejected 99 out of 100 times or more, which is exactly what happens. You know, fortunately, there were some prior relationships I could lean into. I have friends that have been successful who supported me. So we were able to get started off of a really close-in network. But it's hard. It's incredibly hard. And our strategy is so niche in the eyes of a major institutional allocator or investor that they just don't really get it. What I don't like about fundraising the most is people's inability to say no. And they keep you... They just ignore you. They ghost you, basically. There's nothing. I'd rather get a quick no than a ghost over 6 or 7 months where you got to force the no out of them, which is what I've learned I have to do. But that's the part. Hey, chasing someone for a no when you know it's a no, but you need closure, is awful.
Do you have the same feelings about that process?
I have the exact same feelings about the process, other than I don't chase the no's. Like, if someone's not engaging, I don't continue to engage, because for me, like, this is a business development exercise. It's a numbers game. You have to talk to as many people, and to Rich's point, 99% are going to say no. So you have to have extremely thick skin. You have to have extreme confidence. Being a sector expert also helps significantly, I think. I don't know if how you feel about that. And you need to be extremely well-networked and a world-class hustler.
Okay, so...
One time in my life, I chased a no that became a yes.
Oh, really?
Yes. So don't give up.
I mean, like, I just don't have time to engage with losers.
So let's talk about, like, the allocation of time. Is, like, the fundraising, like, 80% of your work? And the things I see about, like, you know, finding the right people to invest in, is that 20%? We can start with you, Rich. Like, is this...
You're fundraising, it's a majority of your time.
Right. But okay,
you,
so let's talk about
don't
that.
Don't fundraise
period,
all the time.
Okay, there's periods of time when you're raising money, and then you stop raising money, and then you invest it. Correct.
Everyone says you're always fundraising.
But like, you're always schmoozing,
you're always engaging.
Because you're meeting people for future raises when you're not raising. That's the best time to actually meet them when you're not asking
when you don't
them
need it
for anything.
Right.
But you're all in intensely focused on raising your fund when you need to raise your fund to stay in business.
Right.
Then you immediately transition to deployment and portfolio management. We have 20 brands and we're fairly active with most of them. And so that probably right now is our biggest time commitment, not to mention all the other just administrative things you have as a founder of a fund running your firm. So,
right. So when you say you're involved in them, you mean like you're really helping them lead the business, you're studying the numbers
sounding
with them.
Good.
Right. Okay. So how often in your industry are you raising funds? Is this like a once a year thing, once every 5 years? We'll start with you, Kara.
I mean, it depends on the life cycle of somebody's fund. In my case, I have a 10-year fund with two one-year extensions. The deployment period is a 3 to 4 year period. So usually, I don't know, 2.5 years into your vehicle, you're usually going out and raising another fund, I would say is probably industry standard.
Okay. I need the kindergarten version of that.
Okay. So when you go out and you raise your first fund, you have to raise $100 million. Mm-hmm. And then once you're done raising that $100 million, you have a 3 year period that you then deploy that $100 million into, let's say, 21 companies.
Okay. So you've told your investors, I'm going to spend your money in the next 3 years.
Yes.
Okay. Then what happens next?
Then you start deploying that capital into 21 different opportunities. And then, but about halfway into that process, so a year and a half, 2 years into that process, when let's say you have maybe 33% of your fund left to deploy, you go out and you start raising fund two.
Because then you'll start this process all over again. Okay, is that a similar process for you?
Well, I'll give you exact timelines for what we experienced. We set out to raise what we hoped would be a $30 million first fund. We started in the summer of 2020 in the middle of a global pandemic. Unbeknownst to us, when we decided to do this, we didn't foresee that happening. Turns out that was probably an easier time to raise than it actually is now. We ended up with $42 million of commitments. Mm-hmm. Our final closing was in October of 21. So it basically took us a year to raise the $42 million. We had interim closings before then so we could start deploying. Mm-hmm. We deployed that first fund into 13 brands. Our very first investment we made was a brand called K18, which ended up leaving us after 3.5 years, very successfully returned over 70% of the first fund in the one exit. We went out to raise fund two, targeting $75 million, feeling very confident given the success of K18. And it was incredibly hard when interest rates are high and investors can park their money in higher yielding, less risky investments, and they haven't gotten any money back from their other funds that they've committed to. They don't want to give you more. But it took us 2 years. We closed on the $75 million, so more money. It took us longer. We have 8 new brands now in that fund, and we have 20 brands altogether. But to Kara's point, you expect to deploy in 3 to 4 years. You have some reserves to follow on in your existing investments. But the way the agreements are worded, you have 5 years typically to invest it. You just tend to invest it before that 5 years.
Okay. So now you're in the business of pleasing these people who just handed over millions of dollars to you. So are you getting phone calls like every day, like, how's my money doing?
We send fairly substantive quarterly updates to the group. Some will check in with us and want to have a call. Some we assume read it and don't. They're not very time consuming from an investor relations perspective.
Okay. Is that the same for you, Kara?
It's my first fund. So I just started fundraising in October and I'm about 6 months into it and did my first close June 3rd.
So that means someone committed the money to
you. Yep. So I have some portion of my total goal, which is $20 million. And then I call that capital. And then I'm going to be investing in my first deal sometime very soon.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. That's the other thing people don't understand. You're making a commitment. You're not writing a check.
Right.
Okay.
Right?
So when does that money come to you?
Gets called as we need it.
Okay.
To use it, we call it. And so it's generally called over a 4 to 5 year period. And it's, and even then there's a tail to fund other expenses of the fund. But people always think, oh, okay, where do I wire the money to me? Like, no, you've just made a commitment. We'll tell you when we need it.
Okay. So you're not holding that money in escrow. Okay.
No, because they'll want to invest it, right? They'll keep, you know, if someone's going to commit $2 million to my fund, they're going to take majority of that, maybe keep it in the public markets, maybe keep it in private credit, other investments that they have where they're making 10% or more.
Okay. And when you make that call, what is the time period that they have to hand the money over to you?
For me, it's 5 business days.
I think we're 10.
Okay. So it's quick. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so thank you for the lay of the land. This sounds very hard. And yeah, I guess you have to like really, like you said, have the thick skin because you're selling. right?
Selling.
I would imagine the other side of the business where you're nurturing your investments is way more fun.
And the problem with fundraising is you always have to be on, and it's impossible. Mm-hmm. Humans can't be on all the time, and sometimes you just whiff. Your one chance to impress, and you whiff for whatever that reason is, and then you have trouble sleeping at night.
Yeah, so we're all salespeople, right? I'm a salesperson at Base Beauty. I have no background in sales as a creative director, and Sarah, our COO, is an amazing teacher to me. I hired her to teach me, and she does. And when I had a meeting with a brand that I've been like literally chasing after, like the CEO is in Australia, and then you know the general manager here, and I finally get the meeting with the head of marketing. And what I didn't know is I was like coming down with like not a flu, but a flu-like thing, and my meeting was awful. She was asking me questions. I couldn't answer them. And I was like, that was my chance.
Yep.
I guess what I've learned over time, I have evidence that like, I'll get another chance, but it does not feel good when it does not go well. Do you have any of these examples, Kara, of a meeting where like, it just, you walked away and you lost sleep at night?
Yes, I'm sure that there have been meetings that's happened. None that like specifically come to mind. I'd say like to Rich's point, you know, I'm tired, right? Like there's some calls.
You're hearing yourself say the same thing
over and over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like at this point in the fundraising, I'm bored. Yeah. I'm sick. I'm sick of myself. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, you know what? I'm also tired of like explaining how fabulous I am and like why you should invest in me. So let me just find the best deal and just show you and like, boom, shakalaka. That's just like where I'm at.
Right. So, you know? I'm hearing similarities in my work. Like my work takes an enormous amount of education, right? Like I have to educate about why this matters, why this service, why us, right? Again and again and again. What do you find is in the conversations you're having with future investors, what do you have to educate them on the most? Is it the industry, the category? What do you say?
Yeah, because we're sector specialized. Mm-hmm. That is a big part of what we have to do. And a lot of them don't. You're talking a lot of white men.
Yeah.
They're not the consumers.
Yep.
You know, I'm the only guy on our investment team. We're four women and one guy. That's not because we're checking a box on a DEI initiative. Mm-hmm. It's because women are better served to understand the consumer for the categories we're investing in. Mm-hmm. That is why we do it. When you're not talking to that audience when you're fundraising, they don't understand the space. They don't get it. They've never heard of any of the brands. Oh, K19, what do they do? Mm-hmm. Like, I literally heard that.
Mm-hmm. Kara, what do you educate the most on?
The opportunity, like how,
like why it matters.
Why it matters. Wellness is a $6.3 trillion industry. Beauty is a $640 billion industry collectively. Like, and I ran this number myself and like did my research. 8% of the capital in the entire world goes towards consumer purchases in these two categories alone. That's insane, and it's super resilient. COVID-proof, recession-proof, bomb-proof, like, and it's only growing exponentially. And, you know, 12 years ago when I got into the industry, when clean beauty wasn't even a thing, now, you know, Sephora, Ulta, they have their own sections of wellness, clean beauty, sexual health and wellness. So it's just taken a really interesting turn. And then now, like, longevity is such a buzzword. Everyone wants to, you know, go to a bathhouse, get, you know, an IV drip, et cetera, where, like, you know, I've been on the forefront of that. And, you know, I think people also hear, oh, you're investing in beauty, health, well, and all they hear is the beauty. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm not just a beauty fund. And there's so much more than that. I'm investing in four-wall businesses. I'm investing in consumer technology. I think that part of just educating that I'm so much more than a beauty fund is also what I find a little bit challenging.
I find it hard to even convince people who they came up as like CPG marketers and like literally what they're selling is wellness or personal care. And they have no idea why it relates to this world. Like they just think of themselves as like, that's the CVS shelf, and they don't understand the ecosystem, like the consumer's mindset, why she wants a beautiful deodorant on her counter or whatever it is.
Well, that reminds me of a fundraising call. It was a no call, which was nice. I appreciate it. But the person literally said to me, he's like, while you've convinced me that beauty is the most attractive segment within consumer, I think if I were to invest in something consumer, I'd want a more diversified consumer portfolio. I'm like, so what you're saying is you'd like to dilute your overall return profile by investing in less attractive categories for diversification purposes only? Like, I don't really understand that. I mean, I get the logic. It actually makes no sense because what I wanted to say, which I didn't have the guts to say, was if I were a prestige skincare fund, I would say, yeah, you need some diversification. But when you're focusing on all the different segments, all the different categories, all the different channels that we're focused on, it is so diversified in and of itself. And our portfolio construction works on continued diversification so we don't end up over-concentrated in one thing. But for someone to say, yeah, you're investing in the most attractive space, but I like some of those too, didn't make any sense.
Okay, you just said that you didn't have the confidence or courage to say something. You don't strike me as somebody who does never who never has the confidence or courage to say something. So tell me about that moment.
When I said that?
Yeah, like, why?
Did I say I said that, or was that Maynard monologue talking?
So, I mean, I don't know you, like, outside of, you know, seeing you at events, but you never, I never got the impression that you don't have the courage to say the truth. And the reason why I want to talk about it is, like, there's a lot of times when I don't have the courage to say what I want to say, and I, like, you know, talk to myself in my head a lot, and I'm like, Jody, you can do this. You're the expert. So I'm surprised that you don't.
I don't like confrontation. If I think it's going to become confrontational, I'm not going to do it.
So if you think it's going to incite a reaction that's, like, unpleasing and unnecessary.
I probably won't do it.
I think also in the moment when you're put on the spot with an LP, like, you're automatically, like, you're not even keeled. Right. Or at least, like, that's not how you feel going into a call. So, like, you're kind of walking on eggshells. And then also in real time, when a question or something is presented to you, you obviously go back and you're like, wait, I should have said this or I should have said that. And I'll give you an example. The other day, I got a no. Because someone who I spent a lot of time with, because I'm not in New York and I'm based in Mexico City, I'm like,
which didn't change. That was the case
from like a deal flow perspective. Like, I did. I was so caught off guard.
Oh, yeah, they knew that when they first met you, though.
And so confused by it. Like, yes, from a deal flow perspective, but I've, you know, relationships from Belgrade to New Zealand to Toronto. Like, I see every.
I think people look for reasons to say no, and sometimes they come up with really stupid ones.
So just be honest. Like, yeah, I could take
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
It actually would be really constructive feedback to hear, you know, I didn't like your portfolio construction, or I didn't like you, or whatever.
Yep.
I'm reading a book. Can you remind me the name of the negotiation book I'm reading?
Never Spoke the Difference.
Yeah. Have you read this book?
No.
No.
It's changed my life. Because I really don't have courage. And I mean, I'm brave, but I'm scared. I don't know. Like, I don't know, really know what the right words are to pull, but like, I desperately want to help you. I know we're the right team to help you. But then when these walls get put up, maybe I'm getting like fake answers and they're not getting, they're not really being honest with me, or business conditions or whatever. I can feel like the tingles in my arms. Like, I'm nervous. I want to be less nervous because I am the expert. We know what we're doing, right? So it's just interesting for me to hear you say these words that, like, sometimes you're just like, I didn't say the right thing, or I didn't take that opportunity, or, you know what, sometimes people, it's not worth it, right? I guess it's like, for someone who just really doesn't want to hear the truth, it's like talking to someone who's drunk. Like, why would you even try to reason with that person? It's not worth it.
I push back sometimes. I don't know if you do that. When I hear a no, I'm like, I actually really would appreciate some more constructive, specific feedback, or like, hop on a call. I really want to understand. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time together.
Yeah. And do you get feedback then?
Sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sometimes I do.
How constructive?
I'm not far along enough with enough no's to like give you an accurate answer.
Let's shift gears. Why the names of your funds? Like, what did True Beauty mean to you when you thought of that name?
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to specifically call out where our area of expertise mm-hmm. was. When we started True Beauty Ventures, it was definitely a beauty and wellness fund. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We had foresight, I guess, because those terms converged well after maybe COVID accelerated that. But we were always going to have beauty in our name. We were playing earlier stage, thus the ventures. And we wanted to stay true to who we are as individuals from a values perspective and from a sector specialization perspective, and so that's how the name came.
So is the True referring to, like, did you see a lot of garbage and BS like before this that you like wanted to kind of acknowledge that you're doing something differently?
I think we've tried to create something unique. Mm-hmm. My team can weigh in and see if we're delivering on that promise, but we do not try to take ourselves too seriously. We try to create a lower stress environment where work-life balance does matter, and we just try to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And we all love, Kevin, before you were talking about, if you don't love it, it's going to be harder. I think everyone who works, you know, for us loves the industry, which is very helpful.
I just don't know how you can do this and not. Like, it's,
I agree.
We can't take automotive clients because, like, no one here cares about cars, you know?
When we recruit, that's something we're trying to test for.
Yeah.
Because everyone will tell you they love it
yeah.
because they want the job.
That's right.
Do they really love it?
Yeah. So we've had people where like their resumes are like they're in the fitness world and like that is this world. That's the wellness. And they just can't do the consumer goods kind of side. Right. So it's I hate like trying to pigeonhole people. But like there needs to be evidence that they really understand the consumer and that they are. It's really about being the consumer, I think, at the end of the day. So why Hive? What does that mean to you?
It was important for me to have a name that was one word that also embodied who I am and what I am and how I help founders, which is I'm ferociously hands-on with all of my portfolio companies. I don't have the traditional investment banking, whatever background and get my MBA. I have a JD and was a sports agent and an operator my entire career building these companies. So it was really important for me, you know, Hive, Beehive, teamwork, working together. Like that's kind of really where it comes in.
I used to like worry like, oh, I didn't go to business school. And then I'm like, yeah, school life. It's fine. Right. You know, like I can read books. Talk to people.
Life is all about who you know and how you work those connections in any industry. And I don't believe that you need to have XYZ to be successful in whatever industry that you're in. And I think that we're going to see a lot more of a meme in the venture ecosystem in this new wave of venture capital.
We're going to see a lot more of what?
Meme, a lot more of like operators,
like
a lot more of these, you know, very untraditional backgrounds of people coming in and shaking things up in the ecosystem.
You mentioned success, and that's a topic I want to get to next. Rich, like when you started in this industry, how did you define success, and like how would you define it now?
Well, when I was younger, success was just having a job and making a living.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated from...
But was it like making a living or like making like real money?
It progressed mm-hmm. over time. When I got a little bit older and was graduating from business school, you know, you and your friends will talk about success being a number.
Right.
What's your number? Did you hit your number?
That's really the conversation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, uh-huh. Terrible. Then you get to the point where success is not having to worry as opposed to a number.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, you get to a point in your career, and I'm older than most who do what I do for a living, where success is, do you love what you do?
Mm-hmm.
Do you like who you do it with? Do you have fun? And do you have some work-life balance?
Mm-hmm.
And so the definition of success changes over time, but probably because you're achieving certain milestones mm-hmm. and you can recalibrate.
Yeah. What about you, Kara?
I think for a long time it was money focused and financially focused, but that also really leads to financial freedom, which for me is success, which mm-hmm. is freedom, being able to travel, being able
to not having to worry.
Same yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To not have, you know, I've never been a great employee. I've always been a self-starter. I am, you know, defiant in a lot of ways. And I do know that like my way in some ways is the right way. So love to be collaborative, open to constructive criticism, feedback on all fronts. But like at the end of the day, I want to be calling the shots, whether it means what I'm investing in or whether I'm going to take my dogs out for a walk mm-hmm. at 12 at noon or whatnot, right?
Yeah. So I'm thinking back to, so I started my business 18 years ago and just kind of like not with any plan, just like there's an opportunity, let me take it. And early days, and I had an infant at the time, like I had no money coming in. So just making that decision to leave the apartment to go buy an iced tea, that's like what, $4? Like I was like, I can't do it. Like there were days where I'm like, you know, we're not talking about poverty. Like I had a nice apartment, but like, you know, there just wasn't extra money for stuff. And then and of course at that time I thought success meant like, you know, being literally rolling in it is the words that I would use.
Yeah.
And now I'm on an adventure because I love it because I can send my daughter to Korea for the summer because that's what she wants to do. And I don't have to worry about it, which is like, it still gives me like goosebumps to be able to just like do that. Or my son wants to go at XYZ wherever and we just send him. Whereas I had to think twice or four times about buying that iced tea. It was just, you know, really 18 years, just a few years ago. So now I'm able to, I guess, the fear of financial insecurity, I always felt like a looming, like, shadow man behind me because of those early years. And now I feel like that shadow has been compressed into like a little ball and like wrapped with like foil and thrown in the freezer. I don't know if it'll ever go away. I think that's just sort of like a founder thing.
How you're raised and how you grew up, I think, also impact that. So for me, I grew up with a family, very little means,
mm-hmm.
a widowed mom, two kids, raising kids in Manhattan, and she was a secretary, so the math didn't work. It was all credit card. My friends used to say I was the richest poor kid they'd ever met because my mother didn't deprive me of stuff, but she just ran up big credit card bills. So it was very important to me not to have to live like that. And it, you know, and because of our financial situation, I had to do jobs both in college and in high school to make money, and that instilled an ethic, I think, that is important to this day. But it was like I was on a mission to be financially free if possible.
I think I'm always going to feel this way, like super scrappy, super lean, that I'm not going to go out and buy that matcha. Like I, you know, tomorrow's not promised, and like the carpet could always be ripped from underneath you. And I don't know what is in my soul of why I think that could always happen. But I think I have a chip on my shoulder in a lot of ways. And I think that I'm always going to hustle and owe it. Like my therapist at least says that, like, it's, you know, I'm like, oh, when I get here, I'll be chill. No, she's like, you won't be. You're always going to want more. You're always going to want better. And you're going to strive and continue to be ambitious.
Wait till you're my age.
Really?
Get chill.
And I'm like, wait, can I just like retire? Like, I think there will be a point where I do want to retire and just own a wine vineyard, make funky wines, and be that weirdo that travels to like my restaurants and suppliers that's like giving everyone all my funky wine.
You know, I take a gratitude perspective on this stuff. Like literally, I'm not joking. Every time I go to Dunkin' Donuts and I go to my and go order an iced tea, and, you know, literally, it's a $2.50 product.
Yeah.
I'm grateful. Like, you know, that I don't have to think about it anymore, right? So, and that I have this like inner strength to put the shadow man like in the freezer, right? Because for years it followed me around. But let's switch gears. We have a game to play. That's how we close out every show. And you told us that you're sports fans, specifically New York City teams. And we're going to do a sports face-off, pick your battle. So this is the ultimate New York City sports rivalry game. We're going to do it this or that. You'll have to pick which one you'd want to be at, which game you want to be at based on the teams, the stakes, or maybe just the vibe of the game. Okay. So this was created by Natasha. I have no game.
Just read it.
I do not know anything about sports teams or New York sports team, but you guys are the fans. So you'll be on this journey with me. So the scenario number one is called a basketball rivalry. It's the Knicks versus the Nets. So we have a scenario, the New York Knicks versus the Brooklyn Nets at Madison Square Garden, which will be in October. Oh, that happened in October. Wait, did that happen already, Natasha?
No,
coming up in October. So this is the first meeting of the season. The energy will be off the charts. So you can go to that game, or you can go to the Brooklyn Nets versus the New York Knicks at the Barclays Center in November, a month later. So the Brooklyn faithful will get a chance to show the Knicks who's boss. Which game are you going to? We'll start with you, Kara.
So they're both the Nets playing the Knicks, but at like different venues.
Home. Yeah.
Oh, the Knicks. I'm obviously going to Madison Square Garden.
Where are you going?
I'm a Nets fan. Barclays.
You're going to... Okay. So...
Unfortunately, going to a Nets game at Barclays against the Knicks does bring a lot of Knicks fans in.
Right.
But I think I'd still rather be at Barclays.
Okay, so I'm a Jersey girl, so the Nets used to be in New Jersey, right? So this is all very confusing for me. Okay, number two, baseball brawl, Yankees versus Mets. So we have the Yankees versus the Mets at Yankee Stadium next month in August. Or you can go to the Mets versus the Yankees, yes, at Citi Field. So we're swapping home venues. That one's in September. The Mets have the home field advantage there. Kara, which game are you going to?
I'm going to the New York Yankee game in the Bronx, and my little cousin just got drafted to the New York Yankees also.
Oh, really?
That's so cool. Are you his agent?
I'm not his agent, but I...
Did you advise on the deal?
I will be advising on the deal.
So when you say that he's on the team, is this like farm team, main team? How does that all work?
I actually don't know exactly, but
if he just got drafted, he'll be in the minors.
Yeah. So he'll be in the minor league and part of the Yankees organization. That's very cool. Okay, where are you heading?
Yankee fan, Yankee Stadium, although I will tell you, both stadiums are relatively new. Mm-hmm. They're both been rebuilt. And I think Citi Field's actually a nicer venue. But as a Yankee fan, absolutely Yankee Stadium.
Would you be booed? Like, would Nets fans next to you guys boo you?
No.
Okay.
Red Sox fan at a Yankee game would be.
Oh, okay. Because it's not as big as a rivalry.
Phillies fans are the worst.
For Mets in particular.
The worst.
Okay. Now we have
In general.
In general. Across all.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
Philly, I grew up in Rockland County.
Okay, and you grew up in Manhattan?
I did.
Okay. So, football face-off, Giants versus Jets. The New York Giants versus the Jets at MetLife Stadium in November. So, this is two hometown teams. It's the one stadium. This is very confusing.
The same place.
They play in the same place, I guess in this scenario, the Giants are home because they're first listed first. Is that how it works?
Could be.
Okay. So I guess which side of the stadium are you sitting on, Kara? Are you sitting on the Giants side or the Jets side?
I'm sitting on the Giants side. I bleed blue. I'm a New York Giants fan through and through, season ticket holder.
Oh.
And I've been going to the game since I'm in my mom's stomach. So I'm going for the Giants.
That's so sweet. And you?
I think both teams stink.
Uh-huh.
I'm a Rams fan, Los Angeles Rams fan, and I will put my tickets on StubHub.
Oh, okay. So we have a hockey showdown, the Rangers versus Islanders. We have New York Rangers versus New York Islanders at Madison Square Garden in October, and that's an early season clash. Or we have the reverse, UBS, that's the Islanders and Rangers at the UBS Arena in November. So where are you going, Kara?
I'll go to Madison Square Garden with the Rangers.
Okay. And are you a Rangers fan?
I'm like, it's fun to watch live, but like I don't really follow hockey.
Okay, and if I handed you two jerseys, which one are you going to wear during the game?
Rangers.
Okay, and what about you, Rich?
I'm an Islanders fan.
Oh, okay.
Islanders Nets fan growing up in Manhattan. That's quite frankly not that normal. I don't know how it happened.
Uh-huh.
I'd probably go to that game at the Garden just because a hockey game at the Garden, irrespective of who's playing, is an experience. Although I will say, if you haven't been to the Islanders' new arena, which is brand new, state-of-the-art, mm-hmm. it is spectacular.
Oh, cool. Okay, the last scenario. New York City sports traditions. If you had to pick one of these iconic traditions, which would you go for? One is a Yankees postseason push at Yankee Stadium, where they're fighting for the playoffs and every game counts. The atmosphere is electric, I've been told. Or Rangers holiday bash at Madison Square Garden in December. This is an annual holiday game complete with festive fan giveaways and holiday spirit on ice. Kara, which game are you picking to go to?
Well, I'm sorry, what was the first
game? The first is a Yankees postseason push, so you're cheering for them to fight for the playoffs.
Yeah, for sure, Yankees.
You're going to Yankees, okay. Playoffs. And Rich, where are you going?
I would probably go to the Yankees, although I believe that hockey live is the best sport to attend.
Yeah, and I bet a holiday themed event at the arena is probably really fun.
There's nothing better than a hockey playoff game with a team that you like.
Okay.
That is, talk about stress on the aura, right?
Fun fact, NHL agents are the least paid out of all of professional sports.
And the agents?
Yeah.
Meaning their commissions are different?
The salaries are the lowest. The commission, I think it's still probably 2 or 3%, but just traditionally the salaries are lowest. Back in the day, I don't know if this still rings true, MLB agents were the highest paid, and then I believe secondary was the NBA, and then I think NFL.
Yep.
That might still be true. I'm not sure. NBA might be number one now.
And this is because the salaries are higher, so my commission is higher. Yeah. Thank you both. This is super fun.
Actually, MLB does have a higher commission. It's a 5% commission versus a 3% commission with the NFL.
Thank you both for this. This is really fun. Thank you for the education. Thank you for talking to me like I'm a kindergartner. I learned a lot from both of you. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
For listening to Where Brains Meet Beauty with Jodi Katz. Tune in again for more authentic conversations with beauty leaders.